media ministry that we shall begin. And so, good afternoon, Holden Village.
Good afternoon.
And thank you for coming. You're very gracious. I guess this is already an example of grace to think that you come into this dark, cool room when you have such a wonderful, sunny afternoon out there. My name is Michael Pellett, and I live in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. And there I teach at St. Thomas More College, which is the Catholic college on the University of Saskatchewan. University there is kind of set up like Oxford and what, in the sense that you've got all these colleges and they're together, they're a university. So I'm at the Catholic college there in the philosophy department, and I teach philosophy of religion, ethics, and then my specialty is phenomenological hermeneutics. But we'll just And I'm also a Lutheran pastor, and I am the pastor at King of Glory Lutheran Church in Saskatoon. And so this week, what we are going to try to do, and I'm sure it's a mistake, is talk about grace, in the sense that I'm trying to talk about the whole history of grace, from its biblical expressions and understandings to some key theological thinkers within the Christian tradition. We're going to look at St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas and Martin Luther, and then a more contemporary understanding in theology, theologies of liberation, and their notions of grace. And of course, that's way, way, way too much to do, but we're going to do it anyway. And so we're off today looking at biblical notions of grace. And of course, this is going to be very much an overview, but trying to give you a sense of what we mean by this notion of grace, and how even within the scriptures there are particular nuances of that. First of all, just starting with a little word enumeration from the New Testament. The basic word, Greek word, for grace in the New Testament is charis, from which we get the word charity, and so on and so forth. And also a sense that goes with it, eleos, mercy, is often the way this concept of grace, and I'll talk about that a little bit, was translated in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures. And when they came across the words for grace, they often put it into the term mercy rather than the term grace. And I'll talk a little bit about why they tried to do that. In terms of this notion of grace or mercy within the New Testament, in the Gospel of Mark, no grace, no mercy. So skip that gospel. Let's move on. Gospel of Matthew does not use the word grace, but talks about mercy three times. Luke, 8 uses of grace, 7 of mercy. John, 4 uses of grace, but they only happen in the prologue. That's John chapter 1, verses 1 through 18. And once he's got grace out there, then he can just forget it and move on. No sense of mercy. And then we get to our friend Paul, where in what would be considered his authentic letters, 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, Galatians, Romans, Philippians, he uses the term grace, and I'm not even going to worry about mercy. He uses the term grace 61 times. And in the other letters that come from what one might call the Pauline school, like Ephesians, Colossians, some of those others, this term charis and its derivatives come up 40 times. So as you can see, it is for Paul that this notion of grace, or at least this term, charis, becomes tremendously important, and it will be used thereafter within the Christian church in terms of formulating our sense and our understanding of grace. But of course, this doesn't mean that the Gospels and so on and so forth do not have an understanding of grace. And I will talk about that as well. The other thing is that grace does not become a key theological term or concept. And again, usually within the Christian tradition, something becomes a key theological term and concept when we start fighting about it. And we didn't start fighting over grace until the time of Augustine. And that's what we'll be talking about tomorrow in the controversy that goes on between Augustine and Pelagius. And I'm sure you were thinking about Pelagius as you were coming up the bus today. And we'll be looking at what their controversy over grace was all about and how indeed, again, it shapes our proclamation and understanding of grace even yet today. So, all right, we're going to start a little bit with the Hebrew Bible and some of the terms there that try to talk about grace. And first one is hanan. And it simply means to be gracious, to have mercy on someone. It is kindness that is expressed in a gift, and it presupposes a lack in the one to whom grace is shown. And so again, grace in both testaments and for us, we have to be clear on, I think, is not simply, or at least what we're going to do here, is it is not a theological or philosophical concept that we're going to try to analyze. And as a philosopher and theologian, I really like to analyze concepts. So this is But what grace is all about is an experience. Grace tries to express the way in which God has been, is, and will be experienced. And so what we're talking about here is the experience of grace. Right. And so hanan is one of the ways in which the Hebrew Scriptures talks about that experience of grace. And it's something that comes to you when you have a need or a lack. And so now, I want to give a warning to all of you. And that is, beware of Diane Jacobson and her Bible study. She has posted there that she's talking about Shabbat, Sabbath. And of course, like all seminary professors, whether they're retired or not, they're sneaky. And her sneakiness came through already in the first session as she talked about Sabbath in Exodus and Deuteronomy and the whole notion that Sabbath was given. Why? Because we need it. So of course, Sabbath is just one very particular concrete way God's grace is to be experienced among us. The way God's grace was to be experienced among the people of the covenant. So she's really talking about grace, even though I'm sure she's going to be sad. But just keep in mind, you know better, and know, her little scheme is up. Sabbath of course, and this is no surprise, the whole covenant is about grace. And part of the controversy that happens when we get into the prophetic tradition, and certainly with Jesus, is the whole twisting of the covenant so that it's no longer an expression of God's gracious work among the people. And so there's that sense, this is what grace is all about, right? There is a lack among us, and God is going to show us grace. And how does God show grace? Well, first and foremost, the most primary way that seemed to be expressed is God's grace is shown through the notion of children. Genesis 33, verse 5. If someone would just turn to that and read it for us, please. Because I'm going to go through these passages rather quickly, again, because of the time constraint, and there are literally hundreds of passages we could look at. I'm just going to take one or two at the most to give you that sense. So Genesis 33, 5. Please, just...
Now right. Jacob looked up and saw Esau coming and 400 men with him. So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two maids. He put the maids with their children in front, then Leah with her children, and Rachel and Joseph last of all. 33. 33.
Chapter 33.
33.
Oh, 5. Oh, verse 5. How sorry I am. Mm-hmm. Does somebody have it? Go for it.
When Esau looked up and saw the women and children, he said, "Who are these with you?" Jacob said, "The children whom God has graciously given your servant."
Okay, so there you go. Children are a gracious gift of God, are an expression of God's grace. And of course, we know that is a primary expression of God's grace, because that takes us right back to Abraham and Sarah. Barren Sarah, no kids, in her 80s, maybe even 90s, old Abe, 100, and God comes and says, "Guess what, my faithful ones? You're going to have children." Yeah, right. But indeed, that's there, right? Their lack, their need, the promises of God, all the promises of God are, of course, gracious. There's that sense of children. And, of course, in this text, a little irony here in some of the stuff you read. This is a key part. This is where Jacob and Esau meet again. And, of course, courageous Jacob still thinks Esau's out to get him, probably will kill him. So what does he do? All those gracious children that God has given to Jacob, he says, "You guys go on up ahead of me." Because after all, if he kills off all of you, I'll know that and I can still run away. So, good, courageous Jacob. All right, that's one sense of grace. Psalm 119, verse 29. And again, anyone, just feel free to blurt it right out. Okay, so what's gracious there? The law. The Torah. God's instruction to us is something which God graciously gives us. Now, why this other understanding of grace, if we would look at other passages in Scripture, it's supposed to be the way a king rules toward his people. A king, especially an Israelite king, is to be gracious to the people. Or another understanding of grace is that one is to have mercy on the poor by giving them something to fill their need. Or another understanding of gracious is how a victor, someone who has won the war, lets off the defeated. And I have there as one example of this, Job chapter 19, verse 21. One would look at that. Job 19:21. And again, anyone, please read.
Have pity on me. Have pity on me, O you my friends, for the hand of God has touched me.
Right, and that sense of have pity is our Hebrew word here, and it's that sense of be gracious, or in the Greek translation of this, they would say, be merciful to me. And again, this comes at the end when Job is just, they remember his friends are supposedly there to comfort him, and what they do is they really beat up on him and tell him, you know, Job, you must have done something wrong, or else God wouldn't be punishing you. And so, you know, bam, 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 they keep beating him up on that. And, you know, come on, be great. And things are tough. I mean, even his wife is against him. Look, I mean, this is just how bad it gets. If you're still there in chapter 19, look at verse 17 now. My breath is repulsive to my wife. I am loathsome to my own family, right? It doesn't get much worse than that. That's how tough. And so Job is in need of grace, of mercy, that something has to happen. Again, just a word count to know, wonderful thing about computers, they can do this for you quickly. This term, Hanan, appears 60 times in the Hebrew scriptures. 43 times, God is the subject. So out of those 60 times, 43 times, God is the subject of this sense of grace. And the place where you'll find this word showing up the most is 26 times in the Psalms. And that shouldn't be a big surprise to any of us either, because indeed, if the Psalms are the prayer book, the hymn book, you would expect to talk about grace and the need for grace. Petitioning or giving supplications for that sense of grace. And as well, grace can also be understood as blessing. Numbers chapter 6, verses 24 to 26. Someone would read that for us. Numbers 6. 24 to 26.
The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace.
Anyone hear that verse before?
Yeah.
Right? The Aaronic blessing. But there is precisely right smack dab in the middle. That God be gracious to you. That God be there for you whenever you experience need or lack. And you think about that, as far as blessings go, what better blessing could you bestow upon anyone? That God be there for you. Any need or lack you might experience. See, that's why grace again is an experience. that we're talking about here, right? It's something that happens to us. It's not just a heady intellectual concept. And again, the Hebrew scriptures are always wonderful about talking about that experience of grace. A word related to this is chen, which is often translated as favor, or of course, the correct spelling, favor. A little Canadian. You guys get it right someday. But, right, that sense here again, that if God is gracious, if anyone is gracious to you, it's the sense that they have found favor or they are going to bestow favor upon you. This notion of favor is not the effect, but the reason why someone is gracious toward another. The key term, again, all over the Hebrew scriptures, we won't look it up because I think it's familiar to you. It's that sense when you say X, or in this case we'll say God. God found favor in the eyes, David found favor in the eyes of God. And therefore, God then is gracious. And it's the sense, again, of grace, because it's not necessarily that David did anything to find favor in God's eyes, or that Abraham did anything to find favor in God's eyes, or that Israel did anything to find favor in God's eyes. There again, the whole Exodus event is an experience of grace. Why should God have found favor, or why should Israel have found favor in the eyes of God? God doesn't seem to be very smart here. Right? I mean, if you've got to pick between mud, stomp, and Hebrews and world-dominating Egyptians, who are you going to vote for? Number one or losers? And somehow, God finds favor, the losers find favor in the eyes of God. And that's one of the surprising things in both Testaments. It's always the losers who find favor. Paul, while we were yet sinners, when we were still ungodly and enemies of God, Christ died for us. Well, why didn't God wait a while? You know, maybe once we were friends, it would be okay, right? Paul says. You know, you might die for a friend or somebody, but you're going to die for the losers? What's the matter? I mean, talk about gracious. Why would God find favor with respect to any of us? And so again, this sense of pain is not the gift of grace given, but it is the reason why someone will look upon someone else with favor. So we have those two that try to talk to us about experiences of grace. The other two terms that we have are chesed and emet. These are the ones that will show up in John's prologue, in John chapter 1, verses 16 and 17, when the Word becomes flesh and dwells among us, and we behold the glory that is full of, and it's usually translated, grace and truth. Usually English translations of Hesed are something like steadfast love. Emmet is something like faithfulness or loyalty. We have these are the ways it's translated. But again, what is the experience behind it that we're trying to communicate here? Again, just for word count, the word hesed appears 237 times in the Hebrew scriptures. And again, not surprisingly, out of that, 127 of those times, it's in the Psalms. So you get a sense again of how important a term this is. Hesed is often linked to community, not just individuals, because what this experience of steadfast love does is it links people together. Think about that. If you have steadfast love for or toward someone else, you're probably pretty close. Or if you have steadfast love toward a community or group, you are linked close together. And so this sense of steadfast love can be a notion that is there between the host and the guest, or within family and relatives, or between benefactor and beneficiary. And that's where covenant talk comes in. When it's working at its best, hesed gives rise to community, and community gives rise to hesed. That's what the prophets were offering. God practices hesed, and it gives rise to the people of Israel, and because they now are a community centered around God's steadfast love, they are supposed to as well express and live that steadfast love toward one another. And of course, they don't. And so, therefore, the prophets go, "Hey, what's the matter with you guys? Where's Hesed?" It's that kind of understanding, right? Let's have this practice at work. It is in deeds of kindness and friendship that steadfast love is shown. Again, it is not obligatory. Hesed is not understood, again, as law or duty. But it's that sense, look it, you know, how are you going to be community? How are you going to be people unless you exhibit steadfast love toward one another? You need that. If there's not some sense of steadfast love being exhibited during our times together here at Holden, this community goes, that's a technical term. It's just gone. It evaporates. And it literally will become a place apart. You're over there, and you're over there, and you're over there, and you're over there, and we're all isolated in our little lodge rooms. Chalets or whatever,
right?
We need hesed to be community. And so God gives it to us. That's the graciousness of God at work. And the other thing it does is that it points to the unpredictable and surprising acts of kindness. It's again back to that notion of finding favor. Why would God find favor in Israel? Or why would God find favor in Abraham or David or any of these great biblical heroes of faith? Because certainly when you read these guys, about these people, they're schnooks, right? I mean, great Abraham, man of faith, traveling down to Egypt. And Pharaoh has an eye on Sarah, and Abraham goes, oh, gee. Pharaoh finds out he's my wife, or she's my wife, he's probably going to kill her. So he says, hello, Pharaoh, I'd like to introduce you to my sister, Sarah. Right? Brave man of faith. And we certainly know about all of David's exploits and troubles. But, you know, Moses the murderer, right, there's another great person. Go take him to dinner, huh? See? I mean, and yet, surprisingly, unexpectedly, God finds favor. God bestows steadfast love upon them and that community. It is an overwhelming and astonishing graciousness. And think about that in terms of that experience of grace in your lives. Why should God show any steadfast love toward you? Why would God find favor toward you? It's a surprise. And that's what grace is all about. That sense of surprise. And what accompanies it is faithfulness. An example of that. Exodus chapter 34, verses 6 to 7. If someone would read that.
The Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for the thousandth generation, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, yet by no means clearing the guilty, but visiting the iniquity of the parents upon the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation.
Okay, thanks. So how long will God be faithful in showing steadfast love?
A thousand generations.
That's, you know, more than a couple minutes. And how long will God show anger?
Children of third and fourth generation.
Third and fourth generation. Again, note a bit of a difference there. God's faithfulness and how it endures. And the other thing, what's so great about this is note, this is here in Exodus 34. This is commandment 2.0. Because you see, we went through the giving of the law and everything back here in Exodus 20. And what happened in Exodus 20 and following, anyone?
The giving of the Ten Commandments?
Yeah, and then what happened?
Messed up. Israelites messed up.
The Israelites messed up. Moses is up there on the mountain communing with God, getting the instruction, words of life, and Israel is down there saying, ooh, how about a golden calf? Wouldn't that be fun? Because, you know, Moses is probably up there dead, so forget all that Moses Yahweh stuff. We got to start over and let's go for the calf. Right? And then Moses comes down the mountain, breaks the tablet, all of that, so that's why we're in Torah 2.0. And yet, what happens? God still makes these same promises. Again, what's the matter with God? You screwed up the first time, Israel. I'm still going to give you all the goodies. I'm still going to say the same promises. I'm still going to exercise steadfast love faithfully, even though the evidence is to the contrary that you're no good. Yep. I'm going to do that. Right. Steadfast love and faithfulness are, again, signs of grace. And what is to be the human response? Response to that understanding of grace, it's twofold. The response to grace, and you may think, well, we're just supposed to be gracious too. Yes, but it becomes a bit more specific. The response to God's gracious activity toward us is praise and righteousness. Praise to God, righteousness, tzedakah, justice toward the neighbor. Or again, as we can often sum it up, love God, love neighbor. That's the response to grace. To God's steadfast love and God's grace among us, that's what should happen. One example of praise and how that works. Psalm 136, verse 1. And again, anyone. Psalm 136, verse 1. Anyone, please read that.
Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever.
Thank you. And again, that whole psalm is going to go through and rehearse all sorts of gracious things God has done. And we are to give thanks, to praise. Why? Because God's steadfast love endures forever. That's that response of praise. And again, the response of righteousness and living righteously among others, among the people, is throughout the Hebrew scriptures, in all the prophets and everything. Again, I'm not going to look at that for the sake of time. So to summarize, what we have here is that God's grace or loving kindness is not understood to be merely an inner disposition of God, but God's dynamic love for people, revealed in acts, like the Exodus, like the giving of the law, which demonstrate that love in ways which are surprising and unexpected. The words for grace in the Hebrew scriptures stress God's presence to and concern for people. And it expresses divine solidarity, especially with the weak and the oppressed. Hesed, steadfast love, emphasizes a love transcending duty, a love unmerited and overflowing in abundance. Human response to the God who has first loved humans is expressed in praise and thanksgiving, righteousness, and love for neighbor. That's our overview of grace from the Hebrew scriptures. Yes, please.
Grace in the English language is a noun, correct?
Yes.
Yet, in everything you've said, it's not a noun. It's a verb or an adverb. It's God's action toward us, not a name of a person, place, or thing.
Yes. Right on. That's true. I mean, Cain is trying to be the nominative form of that. But what the Hebrew scriptures want you to understand about grace is it's not, like I said, an inner disposition or quality or stuff. You know, you can't go to the store and buy 5 pounds of grace. It is a verb. It is an action. It is the way, and the understanding here is the primary way God works among us. That's right. So keep grace a verb. New Testament. And for that, a very brief sense of classical Greek and how we get this word again, charis. In classical Greek, charis, or the root char, C-H-A-R, here for Anglicans, is literally, it means that which sparkles or gleams. Think about a diamond or a jewel. And because it sparkles or gleams, it delights or gives pleasure. We find favor in it. Oh, now you see where we're going, right? So, charis is that which brings joy. And therefore, it is something that is attractive, charming, elegant, or we may say graceful. So that grace, in this sense, in the classic Greek sense, is kind of an aesthetic term. Think about the ballerina. She is so graceful. And of course, that brings us delight as we see her dance. And in that sense, she then gets our favor.
Charismatic. Maybe a root word, charismatic?
It's from this word, charis, grace, yes. And therefore, again, as we see, something that is charismatic is something that is a specific and particular gift which has that quality. So to be charismatic means that it has that giftedness. They've been given that charism, that grace, that gift. And therefore it's something that's attractive, something to be desired. All right, from that understanding then, we pick it up in the New Testament. And the New Testament is going to, again, refine and understand that sense of grace. And the key theme in the New Testament throughout this is the understanding of Christ as grace. And Christ is gracious, because Christ provides us with a new possibility for life, a new life. Grace is a new life and a new way given by God in Jesus Christ. The first thing, and this is again, I guess being a little sneaky too, the first way in which grace can be understood, and the word not used, is in the New Testament when we talk about the way. And again, it's one of those little innocuous words. The Greek word hodos, road or way, which we've had already from the Hebrew scriptures, ex hodos. The road out. That's the other way of talking about leaving Egypt. They took the road out, the Exodus. Here, for us as Christians, it was the sense of the way. It was the road which God graciously gives us. When you read the Gospels, Jesus is always on the way. And while Jesus is on the way, all sorts of things happen. He's going to encounter lepers, and he's going to encounter tax collectors and sinners, and he's going to encounter, for some of you who were here the last week and heard a little bit about the mispronunciation, you know, he's going to encounter the 12 despicables, which really is not a bad understanding. And he says to the despicables, come follow me on the way. And of course, that is what happens to us too. We are asked to follow on the way. First Christians are noted as followers of the way. Acts 9, verse 2. Someone please read that. Acts 9, verse 2.
And asked him for letters to the synagogues at Damascus, so that if he found any who belonged to the way, men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem.
Right, so we're talking about Paul, right? Paul on the way to Damascus to arrest and seize the followers of the way, gets stopped by Christ, who says, you're going the wrong way, Paul. And all of a sudden, Paul now is a follower of the way. Astonishing, unexpected. Who'd have thunk it? Right? Paul, the zealous Pharisee, who's out there to get all those Christians stopped and told, you're going the wrong way. That's grace. That is the experience of grace that Paul recognizes. Right? And again, you think about this in terms of a notion of conversion. Right? What else is, right? To convert literally in metanoia and all that. Yeshua, turn around! Because we're going the wrong way. So converting, and of course, it's God who does that. It's Christ who does that. It's the work of the Spirit. Luther's third article of the Creed calls, gathers, enlightens, turns us around. That conversion, graciously taking us on the way. Another sense of this notion of way. John 14, verses 1 to 7. And if someone would read that for us, please. John 14, verses 1 to 7.
Do not let your hearts be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house,
are many dwelling places. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and will take you to myself, so that where I am, there you may be also. And you know the way to the place where I am going. Thomas said to him, Lord, we do not know where you are going. How can we know the way? Jesus said to him, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you know me, you will know my Father also. From now on, you do not know him and have seen him. You do know him and have seen him.
Okay. Thank you. John 14, 1-7, and again, many of you know, is a text that is often used for funerals. In my father's house are many, we still might use that old term, mansions, but we're not really talking about big mansions. The sense of dwelling places, kind of holiday inns where travelers get to rest while they're on the way. And this sense of way, when Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, the life that is there, again, the tendency for us might be to think about that way as a very narrow and restricted path that's a whole sense of duty. Right? Oh, well, we better follow in the path. We better stay on the way that Jesus commands, because if we fall off the way, we're done for. But see, again, that misses the whole point. Because this sense of way, just like all covenant and everything, is a sense of grace. It's not a sense of law and duty and demand and obligation. This is graciously providing the way. And the other thing about this way and the dwelling places, if you follow John all the way through, is you find out he's not really talking about heaven at all. And again, for time, let me go, right, Paul, the word for place, tapos. John uses that very specifically throughout the rest of his gospel. Because from chapter 14 to the end of John's gospel, Jesus is going to show us the way. And he's going to go to the dwelling places along the way where we're going to go. So let's follow that itinerary. And if we follow that itinerary, and I'll just give you a few references here. We won't have time to read this all. The first place, chapter 18, verses 1 and 2, the place we go to is Gethsemane. And it is the place of betrayal. And then we go along to chapter 19, verse 13, where Jesus is taken in Pilate's headquarters to the place of the stone pavement. And again, that word tapos, place, shows up. They're very purposeful. You know, you could have just said, then they went to the stone pavement. But no, it's this place. And that, of course, was the place of judgment. And then in 1917, Jesus goes to the place of the skull, Golgotha, the place of death. And then in 1941, the place is the tomb. And so, how's this for good news? When Jesus says, I go to prepare a place for you, and Thomas said, well, I don't know the way, where are we going? Well, here's your itinerary. We're going to betrayal, then judgment, then death, and the tomb. I can hardly wait. But, let's be real. In all our life, we do find ourselves in places of betrayal and judgment and death, and we're up there on the graveside, or maybe even in it. Right? This stuff doesn't just happen to Jesus, this stuff happens to me. And we're back to lack and need, aren't we? Because when I'm facing places of betrayal, judgment, death, I'm hurting. And who's gonna be there? Who's prepared the way that I can deal with that place? Jesus. And that's pure grace. Right? The only way I'm gonna get through that is if gracious Jesus has been to those places, prepared them for me so that I too can get through betrayal and judgment and death in the tomb. And on top of that, then, we also know that that's not the last word. We've also got one more place in chapter 20. And that's the place where Jesus is risen. And where is Jesus risen? All over the place. Right? Whether your disciples hiding still in fear in the upper room, or out there fishing and not catching anything, or wherever you may go, as Jesus ends up saying, well, you know, Peter, you're going to end up crucified. The beloved disciple will live longer. Right? Wherever place you go, the risen one is also with us. That's the last word. And of course, that too is a gracious word. So that's what's happening here. That's the sense of grace that we have. Expressed in a way where, lo and behold, the word grace never shows up. But you can't get any more gracey than this. Right? What could be more gracious than that? All right, 5 minutes for Paul. We may do a little bit of Paul tomorrow. But what I want to say about Paul, and again, as the chart showed, Pauline material uses the word grace 101 times. I want to pick out one passage, Romans 8:32, as kind of a paradigmatic passage for Paul's understanding of grace. Romans 8:32, and this is a little twist here, this is my own translation. God, who did not spare his own son, but gave him up, or it could be handed him over, for us all, will he not also grace us all things with him? Now, if you've got an NRSV, the word there is, won't he give us? And yeah, and that's okay, but that verb that's there is charistatai. Right? It's that charis word. It's again using grace as a verb. God graced us. And the thing here is God first and foremost graced us with Christ. And Paul says, given that God graces us with Christ, will not God grace us with all things
So we're given even more than Christ. Right? In some senses, now you know this could be controversial, but I think this kind of outdoes John 3:16. Simply because you've got the sense of Christ, right? God so loved the world, God gave the only Son. Yeah, we got that here too. But Paul has kind of said, and everything else. Right, top that one. God's gone over the top. Given us Christ and everything. Secondly, for Paul, one thing to note, that again, if we look at both the Gospels and Paul, we will understand that Jesus is the event of grace. Right? So that again, if we're going to look, we talked about grace as a verb, Jesus, like all of us, if you will, is an event. Yeah, I'm going to go off on this tangent. Please be gracious. Why event? We are all event. What makes you you is the event that you are. It's not your stuff, your flesh. We've all got bones, probably about the same number of bones, and we've all got flesh, some of us a little more, some of us a little less. Some of us have hair, some of us don't, whatever. But that isn't what makes you you. Right? Your name names the event that happens between your birth and your death. What happens, my experience of me and experiences to me between my birth and my death is what I name another's name, Michael. And that's who you are. You are that event. Jesus names the event of God's graciousness to us. And the way God works graciously is that God incorporates us into that event. Does that through baptism, Paul says. Does that, Paul says, how do we get incorporated into the event of grace by Jesus? Romans 6, for example. I have been crucified with Christ, and I have been raised with Christ. That's what happens to you. And that event of grace keeps happening. We keep reminding ourselves with, at least in the Lutheran tradition, Luther's sense of daily remembering our baptism. Daily crucified, daily risen. It happens whenever we celebrate the Lord's Supper. As often as you eat of this bread and drink of this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death, and it's even more than that, you participate in the Lord's death until he comes. For all of us older types, baptism, Lord's Supper, worship is a happening. Remember that old word? Those of you of the hippie era, ooh, it's a happening. This is the real happening. This is the gracious happening. Baptism, Lord's Supper, proclamation of the word, prayer, singing hymns, Bible study, talking and consoling one another in Christ's name. Those are happenings because that's where grace is happening. And that's what Paul's doing in all of his letters when he's proclaiming grace. He's saying, hey, my dear friends in Christ, Christ is happening among you and happening in you. Cruciform. conformity and resurrectionization. That's even tougher to say than what I'm missing. Right? But that's what's going on in you. Cruciformity and resurrectionization. Think about that for a while. That's what Paul is talking about when he uses that term, charis and grace. And we know that as well, because out of charis, we use that word all the time when we talk about eucharistic, right? Eucharist, giving thanks, thanksgiving, right? Well, literally, it's good grace. So when we celebrate the Eucharist, we're celebrating good grace. Doesn't get any better than that. And that's the event that's happened. That's what Paul draws the Romans and the Corinthians and the Thessalonians and the Philippians into all of that. And that's what's going on. And we're done. Thanks for being great.